The Tom Woods Show, episode 1889.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Always a pleasure to have Brian McClanahan on the show. Brian teaches courses on history over at my website, libertyclassroom.com. He is the author of numerous books, including The Founding Fathers' Guide to the Constitution, How Alexander Hamilton Screwed Up America, 9 Presidents Who Screwed Up America, and 4 Who Tried to Save Her, and more. And of course, he is the host of The Brian McClanahan Show. You can check him out at brianmcclanahan.com. That's Brian with an O. And I just want to talk to him about the sorts of things he's been talking about on his show lately. So we'll talk about DC statehood and court packing. We talked a little bit about that with Kevin Gutzman. But I want to start off with a little experience I had in Charleston, South Carolina recently. So Brian, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. As usual, you're covering a lot of great topics on The Brian McClanahan Show, which I cannot recommend highly enough. BrianMcClanahan.com is your website, Brian with an O. So check out The Brian McClanahan Show. I'll link to it on the show notes page, which I guess is tomwoods.com/1889. And of course, you can just search for Brian McClanahan on a podcast app. But anyway, a couple things I wanted to talk to you about. I took a trip to Charleston recently, and I couldn't help noticing that there's a Calhoun Street in Charleston. Now, by the way, I just fell in love with this place. I guess I'd been there once before for a conference, but in the old boring woods days, I used to go for a conference, stay in the hotel, and then go home. I just didn't venture out, and I am so different now. Now I want to go see everything.
Right.
And what a time I had in Charleston. It just beautiful, wonderful, great. I don't know what else to say about it. Absolutely unique. But there was Calhoun Street staring me in the face. So I know I've done an episode on him before, and you've got, I now can't remember if it's you or Clyde who has a really good book chapter on Calhoun. You guys morph into one person for me after a while. But if you had to, in a short span of time, tell people why it's not enough to say about John C. Calhoun, oh, well, he supported slavery, so he doesn't have anything worthwhile to say. After you're done rolling your eyes at that, what do you say?
Well, you know, first of all, I agree with you on Charleston. It's like stepping back in time. It's such a beautiful place. Now, there is a, I don't know if you saw it, but there is an old Calhoun mansion there. It's not Calhoun's house. Of course, Calhoun never lived in Charleston, but they've changed the name of that because you can't have Calhoun Mansion now in Charleston, South Carolina. Eventually, they'll probably get to the name of the street. Who knows?
Yeah, I was just thinking that's got to be a matter of time.
Right.
Because nobody fights back.
Right. And they'll take down, they'll probably move his tomb there. By the way, it's the most visited tomb of a vice president in the United States. And the last time I was there, I was at his tomb. And I'll get to your question. I was at his tomb. And I'm standing there and I'm looking at it. And all these people come in and they're not from South Carolina. And you could tell by the way they were speaking. But who's this guy? Who's this guy? Oh, that's Johnson. Oh, I don't even know who that is. I mean, it's amazing that Americans are so completely dense about who this guy was. But John C. Calhoun is one of the most important people in American history outside of this positive good speech, which I make an argument wasn't really that unique. I mean, at the time, other people had been saying these things in 1837 when he made that speech for over 130 years in the United States.
Well, but by the way, let's back up. I don't want to assume everybody knows what the positive good speech is. And by the way, before that, I want to tell everybody, I didn't even tell Brian what we were going to talk about. In fact, I've had to rush around this morning because of an unexpected errand I had to run. So basically, Brian got on. I'd given him no prep, told him no topics. I just said, all right, let's start recording. And then I threw this Calhoun thing in. So as he's giving this presentation to you, bear in mind, this couldn't be more spontaneous. There was no prep whatsoever that went into this. All right, so go ahead, Brian. I'm sorry.
Right. So this positive good speech is where Calhoun stands up in 1837. There's a debate on slavery, essentially, in the Congress. So it's not centered on that. But you had all these petitions flooding into the United States Congress from around the North, essentially, saying that, you know, we need to discuss slavery. And these had all been tabled for a long time. The Congress decided this wasn't in their purview. They couldn't really talk about ending slavery. It's not one of the delegated powers of the Congress. And so you had this position of Virginians primarily in the South that slavery was a necessary evil. They were looking at it in a way that, well, you know, it's something we inherited. We don't really know what to do with it. We got to kind of keep it around. But, and then Calhoun stood up and said, well, wait a second here. I mean, we're looking at this wrong. I would say if it's an evil, let's end it right now. But nobody's willing to do that. So is it not a positive good? Now, we can look back at that now and say, oh my gosh, this is shocking. Anyone who stand up and saying slavery is a positive good is absolutely off their rocker in the 21st century. Calhoun was saying something, though, that had been said by as early as 1701 in Massachusetts, by a man named John Saffin, who had argued the same exact thing. Look, I mean, is slavery not a positive good for slaves who were brought over from a savage place in Africa? And again, these are shocking statements for us in the 21st century, but this is something that had been said for years. So when Calhoun said these things, he wasn't saying anything that other people hadn't said. This was not the unique part of Calhoun's philosophy, but it's what everybody points to. John C. Calhoun, defender of slavery. And I think back to Samuel Flagg Bemis, who wrote a book on American foreign policy, secretaries of state. And here's Calhoun looking, he has hairs combed back. He's got the sunken face. He's got tuberculosis. The man is dying. And he's this demonic-looking figure. And that's what everybody thinks about Calhoun. Nobody ever points out the young portraits of Calhoun. He's a very handsome man. He was charming. People love to talk to Calhoun. He wasn't this cast iron man that didn't tell jokes. If you ask Clyde Wilson about this guy, I mean, he says that whole impression of Calhoun is wrong because Calhoun was a charming individual, someone who had a good sense of humor. He wasn't, someone that just talked about politics and nothing else. And we see this all the time. I think you've said it about libertarians where you have, they go and it's all they want to talk about, politics, nothing else. And there's nothing to them, right? And we all have lives. We all do other things. And Calhoun certainly had that as well. But when you talk about government and you look at what Calhoun said about politics, American society, when it came to government, the powers of the general government, the powers of the states, this was an original thinker. In fact, his disquisition on government is still studied around the world for what he talked about and what minorities could do to resist unconstitutional usurpations of power by the numerical majority. So he came.
Let me just interject that Murray Rothbard, Mr. Libertarian, loved the disquisition on government. So that's worth bearing in mind. And secondly, you and I have been mentioning Clyde Wilson. I just want people to know Clyde Wilson is the editor of the Calhoun Papers and until recently was a professor of history at the University of South Carolina. All right, go ahead. And right, and you were his very last PhD student.
I was his very last student. And the left hates that. Anytime they attack me, they always bring that up. Oh, this guy was with Clyde Wilson. Obviously, he's a Nimrod. So anyways, when you have those people hate you over that, it means that you're doing something right. So you've got Calhoun saying these wonderful things about power. And I think anyone on the left or right, it doesn't matter who you are. When Trump was in office, what did the left do? They constantly chirped about autocracy, power. Biden even did it in his last speech to Congress. We came in, we were facing autocracy. Well, Calhoun said that. Look, we've got a situation where the government's going to be too powerful. And what's going to happen is you're going to have both sides. When they're out of power, they're going to chirp about the Constitution. There's too much power. And then when they get in power, they're going to abuse power. So what do we need to do? We need to come up with a way to work in this system to make this impossible to happen. And he came up with this idea of a concurrent majority where essentially, and to boil this down, if any state objects to a proposal, well, then it's null and void. Now, we can look at this and say this is very dangerous because let's just say we want to pass a law and 49 states want it, but the 50th state doesn't. Well, then it doesn't become law. Well, in that way, does it not protect, maybe it was a law that was dangerous to that state. Does it not protect the minority in that situation from an abusive law? Or we could say that maybe you can cut that back from one, but maybe 10. You could have a way to put some teeth essentially in the 10th Amendment, which would block unconstitutional federal power. In other words, you wouldn't have most of what happens in the federal government today because that would have all been knocked down. One or two or three states would have knocked it all down. This is exactly what Canada does. They have this provision when it comes to certain parts of legislation, they can do these things. And so Calhoun was far-seeing when it came to what these powers, what government should be able to do to block unconstitutional power. And he said just great things about government when it came to, what any libertarian would stand up and say, yeah, I mean, we think that Congress is abusive. We think the president's abusive. Calhoun said the same thing. So I like Calhoun for those reasons, and I think more Americans should like him too.
So it seems that the real reason that they would actually have a problem with him, I refuse to believe that the American establishment likes or dislikes somebody out of moral conviction. You know, that is an impossibility for me to believe that. That has nothing to do with it whatsoever. They don't mind supporting people who have horrendous ideas. They don't mind supporting a, you know, former KKK grand wizard, as long as now he supports the expansion of federal power. They don't mind people who covered up communist crimes. They themselves half the time covered up communist crimes or tried to make excuses for them or would say, well, at least Fidel Castro gave you free health care. I mean, these people have zero moral authority to tell me anything at all about John C. Calhoun. So it is literally impossible to think that that is why they don't like. Why they don't like him is that they see where his thinking leads, which is a sharp curtailment of the power of the political and expert class to rule unconstitutionally over the American people. That's what it is. And by the way, I use the phrase, the American people, Calhoun's spinning in his grave. He knows what I mean. I mean the peoples of the states. I apologize.
Well, I think you're 100% right. Now, I would say, though, that in the modern climate, you know, with the cancel culture, they're going after people that they may not have gone after before. I think it's going to consume its own. For example, when Jimmy Carter was elected president, or when he was running for president, I should say, there's a very famous picture of Jimmy Carter sitting there with George Wallace. Now, can you imagine anyone? We saw this with Biden. This was brought up during the campaign. Hey, you used to be buddies with these Southern senators who were segregationists. And he had to defend himself over this. So I think some of this is changing because of cancel culture. But you're right. I mean, for years, look, it didn't matter what these people did. And I still think there's some of that to this. You know, it depends on who they are, what they're advocating. It doesn't matter who they were. As long as they're advocating the right positions and there are guys, well, then we're going to support them. And I think that Calhoun's opposition from the neoconservatives as well, they hate Calhoun. Look, they absolutely despise the man because he was against their notion of what America was, and which is very much in line with the left thinks America was. So they hate Calhoun because they think he's blocked all these things, this one nation, indivisible, this one people ideology. Calhoun would have been against that too. So Calhoun is problematic for those who advance certainly a nationally oriented vision of America. And that's why he is a great asset to those who want liberty, who want to decentralize.
Hey, everybody, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, BitTrust IRA. There is plenty of discussion of Bitcoin these days. A lot of I told you so's floating around out there and a lot of interest in it. And I have just the thing for people who are looking to add Bitcoin to their retirement account, looking to diversify their portfolio toward new innovative investments, or who just find the cryptocurrency world confusing and don't know how to get started. Well, some people are saying crypto assets present the best opportunity to build generational wealth since the discovery of oil. And BitTrust IRA helps you seamlessly and securely add cryptocurrency to your portfolio. BitTrust IRA stores your private keys in nuclear bunkers with military-grade encryption, and they have a 24/7 trading platform with no minimum investments and unlimited trades, plus a team to help guide you along the way if you have any questions. They also offer the lowest trading fees in the industry. Well, go to bittrustira.com/woods today to learn more. And for a limited time, BitTrust IRA is waiving the sign-up fee for Tom Woods Show listeners. That's a $50 value. That's bittrustira.com/woods, bittrustira.com/woods. Now, let's shift gears completely because there's another unrelated question I want to ask you about, and you devoted a podcast episode to it recently, and that has to do with statehood for Washington, D.C. Now, statehood for Washington, D.C., like court packing, is one of these issues that really, you know, you'd hear it talked about here and there, but nothing ever came of it. But when the left decides it wants something, suddenly it's front and center and everybody has to talk about it. That's the difference between left and right in this country. The left gets in and doggone it, they are going to expand their power. And the right gets in and is all apologetic and wants to have a union cabinet or some kind of thing, you know, right. Let's reach out to them, whatever kind of crazy nonsense, right? But they are determined to do it. So explain to me, I mean, I think we all know why they want to do it. It'd be another state in their pocket. But first of all, let's start with the history. Why, from the beginning, did D.C. not have statehood?
Well, because it's in the Constitution. There was a federal city. There had to be something. The founding generation understood that if you put the capital of the United States in a state, let's just pick any state. We can say Massachusetts, New York, Pennsylvania, back at that time, Virginia. It doesn't matter. Well, that state then can control that city. And the cities are corporate entities of the state. So if you put it, say, in Boston in 1788, well, Massachusetts could say, you know what? We control the city of Boston. You can't come here today, or New York, or Philadelphia, or you know, pick some other state in Virginia, Richmond. Let's say we put it in Richmond. Well, the state then controls that entity. So they wanted to keep a state that was independent so that the general government could not be blocked from having access to it or control over it, because they thought that was dangerous to the ultimate security of the United States. And you can buy that argument, right? I mean, if the state can control the capital, well, then there's going to be a real problem here. It could be in the future. So they created this state, and eventually, essentially, initially it was in New York, and then it was in Philadelphia, but they wanted to create something else. So we get the very famous Washington, D.C. Compromise. It had to do with the assumption of state debts. The Hamilton regime, which, because, of course, it's Washington's president, but Hamilton is controlling everything, says, look, what we need to do is have the general government assume all the debts of the United States, not just to the United States, but also the states. And of course, Madison blocked this, or at least attempted to in Congress. And finally, you had this compromise. Okay, look, if we let the general government assume the debts of the states, then we get to pick the location of this new federal city. And so Washington did it. He went out, okay, we're going to put it here. And it's between Maryland and Virginia. We're going to give, Maryland's going to give some land, Virginia's going to give some land, and we're going to get this state, this a city out of these two states, I should say. So then later on, Virginia took back their land. Now, what is Washington, D.C. today is essentially just part of what used to be Maryland. So we had this independent federal city. Now, in the 23rd Amendment, it gave that independent federal city electoral college votes. And it gave them, or they had this non-voting member of Congress. So we've got a federal city that has a non-voting member, but they also get electoral college votes, three of them, because that's what the smallest state has. And so they have a role in the election of the president. But what the Democrats really want to do is make that small city. They want to cut that part where you have the White House and, of course, the Capitol and maybe the Supreme Court. They're going to cut that down and say, this is the only federal city we have, and the rest of it becomes a state. And so we're going to carve another state out of that. There's so many legal questions with this, though. Essentially, they're going to make Washington, D.C. like the Vatican City, but not an independent country. There's so many legal problems with this, though, but they want to do it for power. They want to get two senators. This is the point. And they think this is more politically sexy than, say, Puerto Rico, because it's here in the United States. How can you deny these people in Washington, D.C.? Nobody cares about Puerto Rico, right? Puerto Rico would be better, though, because if Puerto Rico wants to do it, it would be an easier avenue to statehood. But there are still people in Puerto Rico that don't want to be a state because that comes with pitfalls as well. So they want to maintain their territorial status. So we've got the 23rd Amendment is the big one. I think it's the big elephant in the room. What do you do with the 23rd Amendment if you make D.C. a state or create this Washington Douglas Commonwealth is what they're calling it? Well, D.C. would still get three electoral college votes, the federal city. That would mean Joe Biden would get three electoral college votes. That's essentially what would happen. Joe Biden, because nobody else lives there. It would be Joe Biden and his three electoral college votes. So you have to repeal the 23rd Amendment. To do that, you got to have three quarters of the states. And I'm going to tell you, nobody's going to do that. So this would be a major problem because Joe Biden can't be an elector. He can't do that himself. This would be a major legal hurdle, and I don't think there's any way around it.
Wait, hold on a minute. Explain the 23rd Amendment and how this relates to it.
Right, so you've got the 23rd Amendment, and I have the text in front of me. It says, the district constituting the seat of government of the United States shall appoint in such a manner as Congress may direct a number of electors of president and vice president, and essentially it's three, equal to the smallest number, right? So we've got this district constituting the seat of the government. So if that's just the White House, the Capitol, and the Supreme Court building. Well, who lives there? You've got Joe Biden and Jill Biden. That's it. Those are the only people that live there. Maybe some staff at the White House. I don't know who lives at the White House. I'm sure there are some other people that live there, but that's it. So you would have, say, let's just say there's 100 people there. You would have 100 people getting three electoral college votes from the sitting administration. And Joe Biden cannot be an elector. Jill Biden can be an elector, but you got to have three. So who else is going to be an elector? And then these 100 people get to decide these three electoral college votes. So imagine you have a tie in the electoral college and the president gets to break the tie with their three electoral college votes. What are they going to do? They're going to vote for themselves. So, and that's what these people do. They vote for the sitting president. So you're creating an entire constitutional crisis by keeping this federal city with the 23rd Amendment. You have to repeal it because Joe Biden can't be an elector. Jill Biden could be an elector. You could have two other people, but I mean, how does this work? So this is where you have a major constitutional disaster setting up if you carve out this little area of D.C. that's going to be the federal city. The way it's structured now, you have a number of people there. Of course, you can get three electors out of that city. There's enough people to do that. It's a disaster. If they really want representation, which is what they're saying, then just let Maryland take the land back and those people can vote in Maryland elections. they could still be Washington, D.C., but they can vote in maryland elections. That would be the way to do it. But that's not what it's really about. It's about power in the Senate. It's always about power. It doesn't matter what issue you're talking about. That's what they want in this situation.
Well, I guess the third thing I'll say is one that I covered. I had Kevin Gutzman on last week, and he's not really shy about sharing his opinions, as you know. And we were talking about the Supreme Court. And so court packing came up, because that's another thing that they indicate they want to do. Even though in the past, when FDR tried to do it, as Kevin pointed out, even some, not all, but some in his own party spoke up and said, come on now, you can't do this. Whereas I feel like at this stage, the anti-court packing constituency in the Democratic Party is not as robust. Let's put it that way. They may not be actively pushing for it, the whole party, but the people who would be willing to stand up and say, absolutely not, under no circumstances will I allow this, does seem to be smaller than before, because they all seem to be crazier and more devoted to power. So, of course, as you know, as we all know, there's nothing cast in stone about the number 9 in terms of justices on the Supreme Court. And so they harp on that. There's no constitutional constraint on us here. So why shouldn't they do it? Now, I mean, if they did do it, the one salutary silver lining of it would be that it would make perfectly clear to literally everybody that this is clearly a political institution. It is not the platonic intellects on some mountaintop entertaining abstract ideas in order to come up with unbiased answers, right? It would be obvious that it's not that.
Right. I think that's true. I mean, every American could see it. Okay, well, they're going to pack the court because they want to win every argument politically, right? I mean, this is what it all comes down to. I would say right now there's like one, you know, Joe Manchin of West Virginia. Our whole hopes of not having the court packed comes down to one guy, right? I mean, can you imagine that? This is what it is. And so, of course, Biden's buttering up. I think he gave his wife a job in the government or something. I mean, this is some of the things they've done. But yeah, I mean, court packing is surely a naked power grab. There's no other way to describe it. And you can show a historical example of this. After the war is over, when I say the war, if you're in the South, you know what we're talking about, the Civil War, right? After the war is over, you have Andrew Johnson as president because Lincoln's assassinated. And the Supreme Court essentially agrees with this. What we need to do, the Congress, they reduce the number of judges to 8. They pulled it to 8 because they knew if they did that, well, then Andrew Johnson could not appoint anybody to the bench. Once he's out and Grant's back in, they bump it back up to 9. So it's been political the entire time. And we know that because of what the Republicans did right after the war during Reconstruction. We know that Roosevelt's court packing plan was certainly politically motivated. We know this is what the Democrats are doing. It's all a naked power grab. And yeah, magically, we don't have to have 9 justices. We could have 39 justices if we wanted. And I think that Gutzman's and other people have said this too. I don't know if Kevin said it, but what's to stop? And I think Ted Cruz said this. Well, what's to stop, you know, if you pack it up to 13, well, then we gain control and we're just going to put 4 more judges on there. So we'll go to 17. I mean, what's to stop us from doing that? You're going to have like 535 Supreme Court justices at one point, which would be absolutely hilarious. I mean, the side of me that just wants the just naked stupidity of the American government to come out and says, yeah, just go ahead and do it. Because, I mean, it's going to create complete disaster and everybody would finally see it. And then we can start talking about something real to try to reform the central government in America. But if we increase the size of the court, all we're going to do is see partisanship at the highest level. The court will become a political arm. It already is, but it's going to be openly a political arm of whatever party's in power.
Okay, let me think of what else I want to talk. Because, I mean, there's so many things I want to ask you, Brian, that I enjoy having you on, and I have only limited time with you. But I guess I want to ask about conservatism in America and the South. Because it seems like even in my lifetime, okay, there's a big chunk of the conservative movement that can't run away from the South fast enough because they just think South equals slavery. I mean, that's as they have exactly the same analysis as the leftists who can't stand the sight of them. And so it's people like McClanahan and Chronicles Magazine and the Abbeville Institute who are out there trying to say a positive word for something the South may have done at some point in its history. I assume this has gotten worse. And so I guess I'm curious about what it's like being a kind of, not to disparage work other people are doing, but kind of a lone outpost out there.
Well, I mean, you're in that lone outpost too, Tom. I mean, at times you're infighting with the libertarians, and you know you've been they've tried to cast you aside. I mean, so all of us who are doing this are, you know, these voices in the wilderness. But certainly when it comes to this, and I'll point to a recent piece, and I wrote a piece for Chronicles Magazine in April, and I knew it was going to infuriate the neoconservatives, where essentially I bashed Donald Trump's 1776 Commission report as being just another side of the 1619 Commission. Because what they do is say, okay, we've got this proposition nation. America is a country based on the proposition that all men are created equal, right? I mean, this is where they go to with that. And so I wrote the piece and I knew it was going to be controversial. Well, lo and behold, Michael Anton at American Greatness writes, I was asked, can you write 2,000 words or less about this? I said, sure. So I write this 2,000 word piece. Michael Anton writes 6,000 words in response.
I saw that.
Yeah, 6,000 words. It's kind of like when Jefferson wrote his opinion on the Bank of the United States in 2,000 words and Hamilton responds with 13,000 words, right? So now that's what I look at this as. So he responds back and of course, you know, essentially says I'm an idiot in the piece because I don't know what I'm talking about. But he mischaracterizes everything I said. He said, well, does McClanahan think that, you know, the it was Lincoln or the founders? Well, of course, I point out it's Lincoln. It's a Lincolnian interpretation of the Declaration and then the war that creates all the problems. And that's the core of all of it. And so the South offers, and even Russell Kirk, right? Russell Kirk writes The Conservative Mind in the 1950s. And he dedicates a chapter to John Randolph and John C. Calhoun because he saw them as important individuals in American conservatism. He also had a chapter on John Adams. I mean, this guy, he was not saying the South is better or the North is better. He was just saying these are people that we should look at in American conservatism. But the neoconservatives, the Straussians, the Jaffaites, these people that are from Claremont Institute, they run from that because they don't want to be associated with these people, as you said, slavery and racism. Well, were the founders racist? I mean, I think anybody that would have an objective look at this, they all were. I mean, they held racial views that were different from us today. And that's just something you have to say, okay, at the end of the day, we can still take good things they said from that, and so what? But I mean, the left runs around saying, well, because they were racist, we can't listen to these people. And essentially, this is what the neoconservatives do with Calhoun. Because he was a racist, we can't listen to what he had to say. But Calhoun said a lot of valuable things, and I think that's why I spend so much time talking about this. John Taylor of Caroline, John Randolph of Roanoke, Nathaniel Macon. You know, you go down the list of the old Republicans. John C. Calhoun had a lot of valuable things to say. Even in the 20th century, when you move forward and you look at, say, the agrarians who wrote I'll Take My Stand, there's a woman, Gracie Olmsted, wrote a mea culpa because she said nice things about that book, but then she found out these people were racist, so she can't say that anymore. Well, was what they said, is it not true? I mean, so okay, we can say these people were racist and we don't agree with that, but did they not say these things that are valuable? And I think that's where the South offers a counterweight to much of what we're seeing today. They said a lot of great things if you can separate them. And even Harry Jaffa, who was very critical of the South, said, look, we can separate Jefferson in the Virginia-Kentucky resolves from the later use of nullification with Calhoun. I mean, Jefferson, they're not talking about slavery or race here. They're talking about something else. So are these principles not timeless? This idea of federalism and what that meant for the South. And of course, the South is pushing these positions more than any other section, though the North did it too. So how does all this work? If we just say racism and slavery, that's an anti-intellectual position. It's just a slap to try to get you to shut up. And there's no dealing with the arguments there. And I think the South offers all of this. If you can peel those things away, and we all recognize, right, yeah, they said some things we don't agree with, but let's look at what they said that is true and valuable and push that forward. And it was it like? Well, it's like getting attacked all the time by both sides. I mean, that's what I get. I get it from the left and I get it from the right as well because I say things that make them uncomfortable.
Well, listen, I know you have to run, so I'm going to let you get going. But folks, Brian is the real deal. He's a great guy. You don't win any popularity contests when you're Brian McClanahan, but you win them with people who know what's up. And Brian is in my handful of really, really good people out there who I'm glad exist and I'm glad are out there working. So check out the Brian McClanahan Show. I'll have Brian McClanahan links also to Brian's books and all that stuff at tomwoods.com/1889. Thanks a lot, Brian. Now go work for a living and we'll talk soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tom. Appreciate it.
All right, folks, before we go for today, for all you health people out there, you will enjoy this website. MeehanHealthline.com, Meehan, M-E-E-H-A-N, Healthline.com. Your host over there is Kevin Meehan. He was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes in his teens, and now in his 60s, he's living with no symptoms of or medications for diabetes. Now, his latest project has been to distill his knowledge on how compounds and foods interact with our bodies into a practical series of courses on cooking specifically for particular health conditions. And he's focused these days on caring for your own health at home through simple food selection. So he's got a clear, step-by-step, easy-to-follow series of cooking videos focused on individual health conditions using commonly available ingredients from your local grocery. And using these, anybody can learn to help heal his or her body. There's plenty of free material at meehanhealthline.com. That's meehanhealthline.com, M-E-E-H-A-N, healthline.com. Or join any or all courses using coupon code WOODS at checkout for a 20% discount. And of course, folks, if you would like a nice shout out for your own website, before you start that site, check out tomwoods.com/publicity. You'll find out all the goodies I give you. A little publicity boost here on the show, and also some resources that will help you get started quickly, as well as membership in my private bloggers group where we help each other out. These are great bonuses, and they don't cost you a thing. So check it out at tomwoods.com/publicity, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.